If the transport available in the north of England were somehow suddenly teleported to the south, there'd be marching in the streets, urgent questions in Parliament, and an all-round major kickoff. So says Steve Rotherham, Metro Mayor of the Liverpool City region. So why is it acceptable in the north? England's north-south divide is one of the most enduring images of geographical disparity in Britain, and it's entrenched by over-centralisation around London, where Westminster upholds injustice and reproduces inequality. So how do we end this disparity for good? Head North is a new book by Andy Burnham and the aforementioned Steve Rotherham, Metro Mayors of Greater Manchester and the Liverpool City region. It contains proposals variously radical and prosaic, from the replacement of the House of Lords with the Senate of the Nations and Regions, to the removal of the whip, the system that keeps MPs voting in line with their party leaders. These changes, they say, will help to rewire Westminster, not just for the North, but for the country at large. My name is Craig Gent, and I'm Navarra Media's new North of England editor. And for this week's edition of Navarra FM, I sat down with Steve and Andy to discuss how they were politicised by the Hillsborough disaster, why Greater Manchester was punished for stepping out of line during the pandemic, and when is Andy Burnham going to run for number 10 again? Andy Burnham, Steve Rotherham, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's great. Thanks for the opportunity.
No problem. So often when politicians publish a book, they're either gearing up for a leadership challenge or they're at the end of their career aiming to define their legacy. This book is part memoir, part manifesto, and I promise this isn't a leading question, but Head North, to me, doesn't really seem to fit into either of those motivations. So where did the idea for the book come from?
The idea came about because of conversations that myself and Andy had had and the things that had happened to us in our political careers. And we thought it might be of interest because if you think about it, Andy was there at the very heart of when we had New Labour. And I was there next to Jeremy when we had what was happening with the Labour Party and the left. And so those perspectives are probably unique in politics, if you think about that, over the last 15, 20 years. And they formed and shaped our beliefs that we can have a better Britain and it needs to be rewired. And so that's the germane of what happened.
Yeah. And just to add, Craig, you know, the book starts with a handshake in a pub. Steve had said to me a couple of times, you know, shouldn't we think about these new roles that are coming through in Liverpool City Region and Greater Manchester? And I initially said no. I said I wasn't interested. And in the end, I changed my mind and we agreed to leave Westminster together. But that was a story I felt needed to be told, that, you know, people may not realise that we took a decision to build something different outside of Westminster. And it was a movement, really, that we were trying to get going back then. And 7 years into it, it kind of feels right to put it all down, actually, and sort of talk about this movement that we've tried to build around English devolution and what it's beginning to achieve and where it might go. If you want a genuinely equal country, we felt, you know, we can only take things so far within the current powers that we've got. If you do want a genuinely equal country, you need to rewire it wholesale, as Steve just said. Because the north of England, in my view, will never get justice and fairness from the current political system in the UK.
So the question of justice and fairness is something that really runs through the book. And in particular, the major defining politicising moment for you both was the Hillsborough disaster, which, as you outline it in the book, really informed everything that was to follow for each of you. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, in regard to, it's not about the disaster itself. I mean, it does tease some of that out in regard to our personal experiences of what happened on the 15th of April, 1989. And Andy was at a different semi-final. I was at Hillsborough. And so I saw things through my eyes and Andy saw his eyes. And then when you start to look at what happened afterwards, and then our parts in trying to uncover the scandal of what had happened with the likes of government and the police and some bits of the judiciary, and certainly large parts of the right-wing media, where they colluded to try to suppress the truth and develop a false narrative that somehow the people who had gone through all of that trauma were responsible for the deaths of 97 individuals. I mean, that was a huge burden to carry around. And then when we started to see it from why that could possibly happen at the time it happened and whether it could happen today, then you start to see other scandals, don't you? And just recently, the post office scandal, where government, again, knowing the truth, put out false narratives, put out lies, and tried to prevent natural justice from happening for those people, you know, many of whom were jailed, those postmasters and mistresses. And so it was that really that drove us to trying to see whether, through some of the suggestions that we're making, there's a better way of doing politics. There's a better way in which you can make this country more equal and fairer.
So we'll come on to some of those proposals in a short while, but I just want to backtrack a little bit to the, your sort of joint plan to run for the mayoralties in the Liverpool City region and in Greater Manchester. Andy, you say in the book that when you were elected, you had a welcome committee of around about 200 people to greet you. Steve, your experience was somewhat different. Could you talk us through your very first couple of days working in the Liverpool City Region office?
Yeah, now those 200 weren't all Andy Burnham fans. Some of them were actually paid staff who were waiting out for him. Yeah, I walked into an office and there was literally nothing there. There was, you know, there was no furniture and there's no computers and there was no infrastructure. And I didn't even have a chief executive and there was just nothing. And I phoned Andy up and he said about, oh, there was hundreds of people waiting, gearing up to get going, you know, chomping at the bit in Greater Manchester. And I said, it's like the bloody Marie Celeste here. I might use stronger language than that. But that's the way it felt. But in some ways, and we both look at this now because it's a great test, really, of whether when you want to change something, it's better to have that blank sheet of paper, or what you're trying to do is to reshape something that's already there. And we've both come to a conclusion that both of the models that we had inherent flaws and impediments. But actually, what I've built now is more in the image that I believe it should be, whereas Andy's had to try and shape the thing that he took over to change that in the way that he believes. So, you know, he had more to start with. But actually, I think we're pretty much at the same point now, aren't we?
Yeah.
That's a great point. So, Andy, I wonder if for our listeners, you could outline what the powers of Metro Mayors are and maybe what are the longer histories of combined authorities in England?
Well, on the second point first, I think I can do a little bit of a boast here, not because of something I did, but something that Greater Manchester did. I think Greater Manchester, probably more than anywhere, I think you may well agree with this, Steve, built the case for devolution out of Westminster to the English regions, because we had something called the GMC in the 80s, like the GLC in London. Margaret Thatcher abolished it, but Greater Manchester never gave up on that notion of collaboration across the city region. And obviously, as owners of the airport, that was the thing that kept the glue between the 10 councils. And they began to make some headway in the new Labour years, although it didn't, you know, come to as much as it should have done, because obviously there was a vision of regional devolution at that point at the northwest or northeast level, and obviously that went down in the northeast, as we remember. And I think when that went down, and you know, we'd kind of come back with this sort of notion of a combined authority, and I think Greater Manchester put that notion to the Labour government. It was actually created at the end of the Labour government, the Greater Manchester Combined Authority, but then it was something that George Osborne picked up and turned into, you know, the roles that we hold today. In terms of the powers, well, I think ours are, again, probably more extensive than elsewhere. I'm, you know, Mayor, I'm Police and Crime Commissioner. Substantial power over housing, planning, obviously policing, fire, other public services, transport, critical amongst all of that. And the thing I would want to get over on this, you know, because I can imagine that there's there are people on parts of the left who are still quite sceptical, I think, about devolution. But I would really encourage people not to be, because through devolution and the deal that Greater Manchester signed with the government, basically the deal was done on this basis, and the book talks about this. George Osborne insisted on an elected mayor, and the leaders were not so keen on that, as you might imagine. In return, the 10 leaders said, okay, well, we insist on the right to re-regulate our buses. And the handshake was done between Osborne and the leaders on that basis. And obviously now we've used that power. I've used it. And Steve has made the decision as well. So, you know, to the skeptics out there, the fact that we have overturned a toxic part of the Thatcher legacy, bus deregulation, in the middle of a Conservative government, surely should tell people that the roles we hold actually do have some significant power to change things for the better. We've done something that 13 years of a Labour government never changed.
Do you think that it's produced some tensions coming in with there being, obviously, within the region, I think 10 local authorities, Andy, giving your office the power over powers over housing and planning, for example. I know that in the book you talk about some tensions with the then leader of Manchester City Council, and obviously some of the housing plans and planning decisions of the Manchester City Council have, you know, raised the concern of, for example, homelessness or gentrification struggles in Manchester. And I know that obviously when you were elected, you really wanted to tackle homelessness as a big issue, which wasn't sort of necessarily then in your brief, if you like. How have you navigated that?
Yeah. Well, on that, I mean, one thing we both try and run by, you know, just because an issue may not be within our brief, doesn't mean we don't talk about it, because, you know, as mayor, you've got convening powers alongside the actual levers that you've got. You can bring people together. You can galvanize the place around a certain issue, as I did on homelessness. And the truth of the matter is, when I came in 2017, Manchester had a fantastic sort of track record around regeneration, but had lost a little bit of sight, I think, of some of those issues around homelessness, and it needed to be refocused on those issues. So it did bring a degree of tension. That's true. But the Greater Manchester system, and it's true in other areas as well, it's really important to stick on the collective and not on the individual, you know, the cult of an individual mayor doing what the hell they want. Well, that's not the model. You know, I'm in a team of 11. The way I could probably best describe it, I'm captain of the 11 side, you know, the 11 aside. And that's the way, you know, it works best. If you don't run it like that, you're going to end up in real difficulties. But we do approach it like that. And GM always has had a culture of solving its tensions in, you know, discussion and in private. And, you know, we've been successful for that. But I also have to pay tribute to the man next to me. And I do this in the book. Steve is changing the culture of Liverpool. Liverpool had not had the same collaborative culture across its councils in the past, it's true to say. And he entered a building that was nothing there, as he said before. But my God, the difference in the Liverpool City region today from what Steve inherited is massive. I don't think anybody has done more to change the political culture of Merseyside than this fella. And I think he deserves massive credit for that.
So I want to get onto the pitch of the book a little bit, which is that, in a nutshell, and correct me if I'm misrepresenting it, but, you know, what I took away from the book is that the Westminster system really upholds injustice and reproduces inequality across the country. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Well, you really have. Thank you for getting the message, and I feel reassured. Do you now?
It's easing up nicely. Yeah.
What we were trying to get over, you've just played right back to us. But it's what I said. You know, we can't have justice for our part of the country, but actually for the North West, read the South West or East Anglia. We do try and say this. You know, we won't have an equal country unless we completely rewrite the rules by which it works. You know, what we have is an over-centralized political system, where political power is concentrated on one postcode, SW1A. And in that system, London-centric views are sort of hardwired into the way public funding is given out. So the Green Book, for instance, is a treasury assessment that gives more money to the areas that have the strongest economy. And we go through this in the book. All of that means the North-South divide is no accident. It's been UK national policy for our lifetimes, basically. And it's kind of head north is about the journey we've been on to come to that level of understanding about it. And, you know, Steve said, we've kind of got unique perspectives that brought us to this place. But having lived through those government years as I did, you know, Steve living through what was going on in local government at that time, the unfairnesses Liverpool has experienced through history, I think we have gone on that journey of understanding, and we wanted to write the book to really lay it bare and to say that, you know, constitutional issues have got to be a first order issue for the country. There's a tendency in politics to say, oh, well, the voters don't really care about that. They don't really care. Well, I'm sorry, we're going to have to make them care, because until you rewrite the rules, until you change the way the country functions, we will never deal with this deep-seated inequality that we see.
I'm guilty of that, actually, Craig. I've said, unless it comes up on the doorstep, is it really important? And nobody's ever said to me, do you know what, Steve, I'd vote for you. If only we had a written constitution and you were promoting that, that's the thing that's most important to me. It's all always about the kids or the grandkids or what's happening locally or about jobs or whatever it might be. But the most stark illustration of the inherent unfairness in this country is when we started to dig into what happened during German reunification and the fact that the differential there between West and East Germany and the fact that the West Germans had a tax levied against those so they could bring the East up to a similar sort of living standard. The differential there before German reunification is not as pronounced as it currently is between the North and the South of this country today. Now, I mean, dear me, if you needed to know why we're talking about, you know, heading north, trying to get people's headspace in the north, not just physically transferring things to the north, but there's so much latent potential that we could unleash and we tease out lots of those areas whereby we could grow our economy and then we can create those brilliant jobs. And that means we'll have better graduate retention, and then the connectivity stuff and all of that, it all links together. But in this country, we've never had an industrial strategy for the North. Well, we haven't had an industrial strategy, really, have we?
So I had told myself prior to this conversation that I didn't want to talk too much about London and the South East. But when I speak to friends from there about regional politics and the North in particular, they always have one question for me, which is, why are Northerners always banging on about transport? Mm-hmm. Now, Andy, in the book, you talk with some candor, really, about your role in getting the Crossrail project, now known as the Elizabeth Line, off the ground in the very, very early days. Either of you, why is transport such a totemic issue in Northern politics, do you think?
I think it's the most everyday illustration of the ambitions that you have for different parts of the country. You know, the transport system almost, you know, speaks to, you know, how much you value the area that you're looking at. You know, you go to Germany and it feels pretty much the same everywhere. And, you know, you come to this country and it feels like two countries if you compare the transport system of London and the Southeast and the Northwest of England. And it illustrates the inequality probably better than anything, because people live it and experience it. And when they're on those platforms and there's, you know, train cancelled, delayed, as we get a lot in our part of the world, as you will know, it just then speaks to that frustration that comes out, speaks to that unfairness, you know, doesn't it? Why here do we get treated like this when there's something very different elsewhere? Why are we always second-class citizens in our own country when it comes to transport? And I just think that issue more than any brings out those kind of feelings of injustice about, you know, differential standards in different parts of the country. But then it takes you to other issues as well, doesn't it? You know, around, you know, other things that are unfair. But it is the sort of lightning conductor for people, isn't it?
Isn't the easy answer to that question, would it be acceptable to have northern transport connectivity down south? Would the South accept what we've currently got? Wouldn't there be urgent questions in Parliament? Wouldn't there be a major kickoff? Wouldn't there be, you know, people marching in the streets? And yes, of course there would. Well, as Andy just said, we're not second-class citizens. As much as people would like to portray us sometimes as, you know, having whippets and flat caps and all that north and it's grim, it's really not. And we've got electricity now and all sorts of wonderful things. But what we need to do is to ensure that if we're not second-class citizens, we don't have second-class services, and our transport infrastructure is second-class. And that's why we make such a big play on the fact that if we got a similar sort of settlement as the South have had, and we don't begrudge the South. I was with Sadiq yesterday. I do not begrudge what the South have got. I just think that we should get some of that. And it'd be an additional £86 billion for the North. Now, we could do some really serious stuff with that amount of money.
I'll just give you an example, though, Craig, on this. So Steve and I talk a lot in the book about having a basic law in a constitution. So that's something we've taken from Germany. Germany has a basic law, which is a requirement for all parts of Germany to have equivalent living standards. And that is absolutely, you know, at the heart of the German constitution. Imagine if we had had a basic law in this country in the post-war period. I say in the book, Manchester would almost certainly have an underground system, and Liverpool would certainly have at least a tram system, but possibly you've kind of got an underground, haven't you, with Merseyrail, but you'd have a very different public transport system. And the question is, well, why, therefore, wasn't that done? Because the greatest of all ironies is Britain had a hand in building modern Germany in the post-war, in the post-war period, and deliberately constructed the Länder structure so that there wasn't an over-concentration of political power in Berlin. You know, we have created one of the most levelled-up countries in the world. Sadly, it's just not our own.
It's not us, yeah.
I'm speaking to you today from Leeds, which I believe is still the largest European city without an interconnected light transit system.
Mayor Braben has just been making the point to a government minister in a meeting that we've just been at.
Well, there we go. See, this isn't, you know, for listeners, a point of sort of policy wonkery either. It's a widely touted fact across the city. And of course, next door to us is Bradford, which is arguably the least well-connected city in the country, the most isolated city in the country. And I think it's refreshing in the book, to be honest with you, that ideas such as the basic law and constitutional reform are, in essence, making a persuasive case for why issues of justice and funding and investment shouldn't be left to the contingencies of who is in office at any given time. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah.
You're bang on. And that's it. So I keep on saying this is not a manifesto for the Labour Party. This is a set of series of ideas, 10 in a manifesto that anybody can pick out. And by doing that, they would make this a better place to live in. They would make it a fairer UK for everybody. And surely, you know, that is something, especially now when you see the polarisation and the politicisation of those issues, that's something this country's crying out for. People feel genuinely left behind now. It's not one of those things that you just throw in as a soundbite. People feel the further they are from London, the sort of concentric circles, if you draw them out, when you get up north, then people just think, well, what's that got to do with our lives?
We say something in the book at the end, Craig, in a letter to our grandchildren, because we recognise some of the things in the book we won't have time to do. They maybe for later in this century. But we make this point about believing in unions. We're trying to pass on our sort of belief. You know, we believe in unions of people, we say, and we believe in unions of nations. So we believe in the UK. You know, I never want to see myself, the UK, break up. But if that is to be stopped, unions have to make sure that the benefits of being in the union are properly circulated to all of the constituent parts and all of the members of that union. And the UK isn't doing that at the moment. It isn't fairly looking after all of its nations and regions. And that's and we also say we hope, you know, our grandchildren will take this country back into the European Union at some point. And, you know, that it's a philosophy that we're putting forward, but unions have to be made to work, don't they? Otherwise, you know, you can't be in, a union won't last if some members are getting all the benefits and others aren't. So we make that big big pitch. But that's where that, you know, that written constitution comes in, guaranteeing fairness across the country. But also just one quick final point on this. It's also important, I think, to protect parts of the British state from unfair treatment by Whitehall. I'm thinking of how national government treats local government. You know, local government has got statutory roles and services it has to provide, and yet it constantly gets cut by Westminster. So, you know, it's the basic running of the country here. You know, the kind of behaviour of Whitehall and Westminster in many ways undermines the functioning of communities and the fabric that they depend upon. And some of these things now need laying down. The idea of everyone always having to go on bended knee to Whitehall and plead, please, can we have something for this? And this idea that the power's there and everyone has to go, you know, that's what's wrong. That needs to change if we're to have a union of nations, which is the United Kingdom, that works for all of the parts within it.
Certainly on the point of the way that Westminster treats local government, I'm inclined to agree. I think, I mean, my hometown is Barnsley, which is the most affected by austerity of all councils. Yeah. And it's not an enviable position for it to be in. Of course, next door is Doncaster, which is in the top three as well. Yeah. And of course, in that context, all funding where possible has been diverted towards those statutory responsibilities. One idea that you put at the centre of your proposals is for a Senate of the Nations and Regions. So this would be an upper chamber to replace the House of Lords that would be regionally assigned on a proportional basis. That's obviously quite an attractive idea that I think is becoming, you know, it's commonly referred to and things that people would like. But Steve, you actually say that you think we're now firmly on the road towards this vital constitutional reform. I suppose I'd put it to you that at the minute, obviously, we've got the idea of Scottish independence is firmly within the political discourse, and increasingly the reunification of Ireland as well, for example. And it's not clear that levelling up has really amounted to what the Tories have said it would, and even less still the you know, 10 years ago George Osborne's sort of northern powerhouse. Why do you think it's the case that we are firmly on this road now?
I think there are those wider geopolitical issues that could scupper this in one way or another. But because we went to speak to Gordon Brown, and he's obviously done a constitutional paper for the Labour Party about reform of the second chamber, and something has to happen. You know, since I was a kid, genuinely, I remember the Harold Wilson government. That's how old I am. And people have talked about some constitutional reform for decades, and nothing's ever happened. And it's because what I said before, you know, about myself being guilty of, when you knock on the doorstep, no one's going, oh, Steve, how about some constitutional reform with the second chamber? But unless you get those structural issues right, then all you're going to do is perpetuate the inequality in the status quo that we currently, you know, have. And so ours are practical suggestions on not just doing it, but a mechanism by which we could do it. And this is where me and Andy do in the book slightly differ. You know, I think there's a way of maintaining the constituency link with our voting system with first past the post, and then using those preferential votes, put them all in a big pot, and then you have your list system, then you form the second chamber by doing that. I was speaking to the German ambassador the other day, and he was telling me about their system, and then there's we went to America, and obviously they've got a different one where you tick different boxes. And so there's lots of ways, but I like to simplify things. And when I was the MP for Liverpool Walton, there used to be Tory voters who'd say, well, what's the point of me going out and voting? Because you're going to get in. There's even Labour voters, to tell you the truth, the same vote. You're going to get in it anyway. And what this would do is it count their votes. Their vote would be of equal value in regard to the proportional representation in the second chamber. So it's something to certainly debate. But the mechanism is only one thing. You need that drive. You need that single-mindedness, because what's going to happen, as we know, is when there's a change of government, I think we all believe inevitably that it will happen later this year, they'll be absolutely bombarded, won't they, with legislation. I mean, the House of Commons will literally be that sausage machine again. We'll be trying to get all these things through, the important things as well. And this could be one of those where they go, well, it's not the most important thing, and it's possibly not the most important thing, but with the collection of ideas that we've got, it's an important part. It's a plank in building that better Britain.
But sorry to jump in, Craig, but I do think people are more bothered about this than sometimes political commentators give credit. You know, last week, one of Liz Truss's donors went into the House of Lords. Within the last year, was it somebody, a 30-year-old advisor, has gone into the House of Lords? You know, in the House of Lords, there are more people who went to Eton than were born in Greater Manchester or the Liverpool City region. Now, how much longer are we going to let this unelected chamber make our laws? And actually, they do make more of our laws, because the whip system means the Commons ends up rubber stamping the position of the Whitehall departments half the time, and the laws are more likely to be changed in the Lords. I just honestly can't believe that in 2024 we still have this system. I personally believe in proportional representation for the Commons. I've come around to that. I've got the zeal of the convert on that issue. I just think people, every person and every place won't be equal until every vote genuinely is equal, and they're not in the first past the post system. However, if you then look at the Lords, we cannot get into the 2030s with this antiquated, unelected system. And I think we've got to use maybe that secondary mandate idea that Steve spoke about. It's a Billy Bragg idea, actually, originally.
So the secondary mandate, this is the idea that you would vote once for your MP, and then that vote would also be taken into a sort of secondary vote, if you like, for the proportional upper chamber.
Correct. You'd take the votes for the North West, all votes cast at the general election. You'd get the shares of the vote across the North West. And if Labour got 40% of the vote, they get four of the 10 peers. I mean, that's simplifying it, but that is basically what it is. And I think you could use the secondary mandate at the next general election. I don't see any reason why that couldn't be done. So by 2028 or 2029, we could have an indirectly elected House of Lords. Why would we not do that?
Well, that sounds incredibly promising, but I wonder why you think the abolition of the House of Lords, which is certainly something that's very popular with our audience, why that hasn't happened already. Because, of course, when Labour was elected in 1997, there were really ambitious plans and intentions around in the House of Lords. And, of course, that got, you know, quite significantly watered down to what we have today.
Yeah, it seems to be one of those easy things to say and yet difficult things to deliver. And I would imagine, I wasn't there at the time, the new Labour governments, when it was proposed, but there's so much legislation that you need to get through, and you need the House of Lords to get through that legislation. So unless it's a proposal that's absolutely concrete in the manifesto beforehand, and that is enacted very, very quickly, then all the attention turns to the day-to-day stuff, because, you know, every single day there's an emergency, isn't there, in Parliament at this moment in time. Perhaps not to the degree that we saw just a while ago with what happened, but there was always, when I was in the chamber, there was always something that was coming in or something that was happening, and it takes your attention away from these seemingly or arguably less important issues. But I don't think it is. I think it's a fundamental issue for the UK.
So I think perhaps the most radical proposal that you put forward is the suggestion of the removal of the whip within Parliament. But you talk a lot in the book about your, you know, each of you, about your very deep loyalty to the Labour Party. So I wonder how you square these things together. I'm obviously keeping in mind that I think the language of loyalty that's used so often in party politics is actually quite strange to voters often. And so I wonder why the emphasis on loyalty to Labour is so important for you both, and how you think that squares with the removal of the whip and why you would want to suggest that as a way forward.
I think you can square the two, Craig, because actually, if I go back to the government years when I was in the Commons and I talk about the Iraq vote, I talk about the vote on tuition fees. There are other votes we can think of, the welfare reform vote, a vote that we painfully had to go through. If Labour MPs were allowed independently to express their views on those things, they actually would have done a service to the Labour government at the time. The Labour government, I think, would have been a better government had it allowed its MPs and listened to its MPs on those things. 19 times out of 20, we would have voted with the whip. But there may just, well, there would be that one occasion where the party in government would need to listen to the to its backbenchers. And I think that in the end, you know, means that the Labour government probably would have been more successful. I also think if you take that issue like Iraq, I mean, it's just not right to me when you take an issue like that or what's going on in Gaza now. And like we saw in the Commons last week, the kind of messiness of the whip and the, you know, the way in which the rules in Parliament operate. The rest of the world should see British MPs voting on those issues without any sense that there's anything else guiding their behaviour or their decision. It should be the issue alone, and independent MPs independently coming to their judgments on those things. It would actually enhance the status of MPs and of Parliament, in my view, if there was no whip system. MPs would have more power over the civil service, because it wouldn't be the case that things could just be rammed through on a three-line whip. There's a reason why the post office scandal, as Steve said, contaminated blood, Hillsborough, Bloody Sunday, you know, thalidomide, Grenfell. There's a reason why this pattern repeats through the decades. Orgreave, massive. And I talk about that. There is a reason why this pattern repeats. And what is that reason? The whip system takes power off the elected state and hands it to the unelected state, because basically it means, you know, things are rammed through on a three-line whip, and often it's the entrenched view of the government department concerned. And that, I think, creates the conditions where these injustices can go uncovered. MPs can write letter. They can have as many debates as you like about contaminated blood, and they have done. They've had hundreds over the years, and only this year will we get to the truth of what happened on that scandal. So I'm passionate about this, as you can probably see, but it was living the whip that kind of in the end made me feel that I didn't think people knew who I was really by the time I left Parliament, in terms of what I was about, what I was trying to achieve. The whip can make a fraud out of good people, because it makes you say things you don't fully believe. It makes you vote for things that go against your principles. And it's not, in the end, a healthy system. A healthier political culture would actually trust elected representatives to act in the best interest and apply independent thought and judgment to some of these big questions.
I think it's interesting to, because each of you give space in the book, and there's a real, you know, I have to say, a motive force, you know, behind it, about your experiences, but also your sort of later reflections on the welfare reform bill in 2015, which of course approved $12 billion in welfare cuts and curbed child tax credits, lowered the household benefit cap, and on which you each say Labour should have voted against, and you felt it really sort of, you know, went against sort of Labour values. But I suppose I'm still wondering if you think that loyalty to the party or to Labour values can be detached from loyalty to the leader of the time, who of course sets the direction for the party. And of course, you know, you did mention the sort of the entrenched views of government departments, i.e. in civil service, but you know, one can imagine views becoming entrenched around the leader's office, for example, as well. Is that not the case?
Yeah, I would have thought that that is the case, that every leader has their own Praetorian Guard, don't they? And that causes difficulties. And the more impenetrable that is, the more distance the leader comes from knowing what the actual belief in their own political party. So that's why you need a conduit. You always need the eyes and the ears, don't you, so that the leader doesn't become isolated. And we saw that, you know, Liz Truss, and then obviously with this fella now, with what's happening with Sunak, you can just see it writ large again. He's not listening, really. And so I think that that's really important for all parties, including my own party. Why it happens, I don't know. And that's why when we went through the welfare reform debacle, that had a direct impact on our belief of Parliament and our critique, really, of whether the system worked. And of course, then that experience was why we said we think that we need to reform this. And the way that you can do that is if, you know, if you did take away that whip system, it would further empower MPs. Because if we hadn't have had the three-line whip, it wasn't just the three-line whip. It was the fact that the three-line whip then caused a division within our own party. And it was likely at that stage that the party could have split in two. I mean, yeah, that's how visceral the feeling was. And this is a party that, you know, I've been involved, believe it or not, since I was 11 in the Labour Party. I used to leaflet for me dad, who was a councillor. I've got letters thanking me.
Oh, Wilson, that's Clement Attlee.
Yeah, he's a lovely man, that MacDonald, wasn't he? So, yeah, it's all that, isn't it? It's that I believe this party, our party, is the most forceful organ for social change possible. There's nothing else that can bring in the types of values and principles that I believe in than the Labour Party. And I genuinely love the Labour Party. It's like you can't do that Lee Anderson stuff, I don't believe that, and change into a different political stream the way he has. That just shows you what a phony he is.
How do you think Lee Anderson sort of made his way in the Labour Party in the early days? How do you think that happened?
Because politics is full of phonies. Just like life, you know, it doesn't matter what aspect, you know. I'm fortunate enough, I see, like, business, loads of phonies, football, load of phonies, whatever it is, music, load of phonies. Everybody who's in that sector, transport, look, they'll always tell you, aren't they, that somebody else is, that they don't believe in them. And it's no different than any other aspect or other sector, politics. So you're bound to attract those types of people. I think, thankfully, it's a very small minority, but and he's an extreme of that very small minority. But the party itself, I think, is still the party that speaks for ordinary people in this country. And that's why I feel so passionately that the Labour Party is the right party to vote for.
Okay, well, I want to talk about the future, but obviously I'm loath to turn the podcast into an election stump. Though obviously,
or a debate.
I appreciate that. You know, given your experiences in the party and the latitude of thought, really, that you've experienced over the past sort of 10 years and stuff. You know, all under the sort of Labour umbrella. I obviously sort of wouldn't expect you to say anything different in a way. But before we talk about the future, I actually want to roll back to the pandemic slightly. I think you have a chapter on the pandemic that really outlines, particularly Andy in Manchester, Greater Manchester, the difficulties in trying to secure furlough and other funding, and especially at a time when Greater Manchester was facing restrictions that were not faced by other parts of the country. And that's a fact that's, I think, still forgotten by many people. I suppose I want to ask you, do you think Manchester was punished for taking a stand?
I think it was. And the cabinet minutes, which I finally saw when I got to give evidence at the COVID inquiry, pretty much says that. If you see them, you know, they wanted to take retribution, really, because we dared to stand up for low paid workers. The chapter you mentioned, I actually called it The Hunger Games, live from District 12. For those of your listeners and viewers who know that film, it actually kind of did sum up how I felt, because I remember watching it in the middle of the pandemic and thought, God, that's us shouting from District 12 in our rags and the capital, all, you know, everyone wandering around eating and drinking. And, you know, the chapter, I say, it was almost a condensed version of everything that we described in the book. You know, this kind of not even hiding the sort of second-class treatment that they were handing out. They were just doing it, and they were doing it blatantly, trying to divide and rule us too. You know, sort of trying to sort of put this sort of wedge between us, which we'd never let them do, but they tried. You know, all of the things that are wrong with British politics were there in a condensed version in sort of late 2020. They thought they could give workers in the north a 67% furlough, even though everyone else was on 80. And even though those same workers would be sent home, you know, without being able to work. And that was what it was about. And it was a massive point of principle. And it exposed, I think, what they think they can do. Because within days of the showdown over Tier 3 with Greater Manchester, London went into Tier 2, which we've been in since July, with no money. And immediately the purse strings were opened and, you know, there was money on the table.
Do you think in the future that, you know, something like a basic law would stop that from happening in the future?
Yeah, and a written constitution. You know, the rules should protect people from that. And I make the same point about HS2. They came last year for their conference. They let speculation kind of mount for weeks, actually, about the future of it. And they cancelled a project in our city, which they'd promised in our city 10 years earlier, and they didn't even have the courtesy of talking to us about it before they made their decision. Now, I don't believe constitutionally that should be allowed. When you have a rail project that goes through lots of local authority areas, where local authorities have spent lots of money on that project, I don't believe it should be possible for a government to cancel that at a political conference without doing proper stakeholder engagement. But they can, because Westminster Whitehall holds all the cards, and that's how they can ride roughshod over people. Local areas need to be protected from an overbearing Whitehall and Westminster and all the random decision-making that you get out of Whitehall and Westminster. You know, I keep describing this in the book. I don't believe more than 50 people run our country at any given time. That is the effect of the whip system. It hands inordinate power to a very small number of people. That is a dysfunctional way to run the country in any time. It's a dangerous way to run the country in a pandemic. And we saw that, didn't we? Those dysfunctional arrangements led to, you know, decisions cooked up by a small number of people being foisted on millions, and people's lives and health being put at risk by that. Unbelievable state of affairs. And actually, if nothing else convinces you, think back to the pandemic, see how that exposed the way in which Britain is run, and then get behind the Head North plan for radical change for a more equal Britain.
So, of course, the Head North plan, as you outline in you mentioned it earlier, very impassioned epilogue to your children and grandchildren, outlining that the some of these changes could really take 25 years to come to fruition, even if they could be implemented within a parliament. You know, we really begin to see the benefit within that longer time frame. And I suppose I want to bring it back to the beginning of the book, where you outline your defining sort of political experiences in your own lives, and how, you know, over the course of a career in politics, it's led you to this plan and to these ideas. I suppose when putting the show together, I've been thinking a lot about our listeners and what their defining experiences will be, their politicizing experiences. And I'm 34. If I think about mine, it's the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course, a decade of austerity and being part of the anti-austerity movement in 2010-2011. But for my sister's generation, she's a bit younger than me, it is 10 years of austerity, but also the COVID-19 pandemic. And so I'm wondering, what lessons do you think the younger generations, the generations you're speaking to in that epilogue, will take from those experiences? And do you see an overlap with the kinds of proposals that you're making in terms of the solutions that they're going to be seeking in years to come?
Very, very much so. I mean, that's why we wrote the epilogue, because for our grandchildren and beyond, read the next, the next generation. I think I've got a lot of hope actually in younger people today, when I kind of hear their worldview and the sort of values that they've got, the passion they have around climate justice, the commitment to equality that many of them have, the belief that diversity in our country is a good thing, not a bad thing. They're growing up, I think, with a very different sort of mindset than perhaps generations before them. That's what I observe. I think achieving all of those things, though, really achieving a net zero country in the right way requires what we're saying. The rules will have to be changed if we're to do it in the right way. And that's what we're getting to at the end of the book, to be honest. Let's be honest about it. Let's have it right and put it on the table. We are of the generation that has messed up politics. Look at the state that things are in. And I'm not going to, we've all played a role in that, because we've all been around when these things have, happened. We probably didn't do enough as a movement to stop Brexit, and there's lots of things we could, many of these things weren't created by the Labour Party, but we definitely could have done more to stop them. And so you've got to kind of recognise that. We've landed at a pretty broken state. And our message in this book is to, your young, Gen Z or millennial viewers, to say, we're giving you why, in this book, we are telling you why we've ended up where we've ended up in the best of our experience, so that you can fix it. But don't think you can fix it without fixing the rules of the country first.
Craig, we were talking before we went on air, and I've always believed that one of the most powerful tools to engage people is music, and we were talking about our passion for a certain Paul Weller and the Jam. But I'd love to hear some of these young people who are listening to this, start to get involved again. And I think I'd like to see more protest songs in the charts rather than, I don't really understand Taylor Swift, but my daughters do. And they're big Swifties and all that sort of stuff. But it's hardly going to try to radicalise people to come out and fight a Tory government or whatever. And I thought music, when it's used in that way, can be really, really powerful. And so I'd say, please form some bands.
Jamie Webster's going to knock Taylor Swift off the top spot someday.
He's
surely,
not 16, yeah. Though, is he? all these kids.
We've got a playlist together, by the way, for Head North. Are you aware of this fact?
Yes. Well, I'm first to sign up for it. I mean, I am inclined to agree with Paul Weller that if we could communicate for 2 minutes only, it would be
a start.
A restart. Ooh, exactly.
Yeah, like
so,
it,
well, just to round up then, I mean, Steve, you've ruled yourself out already, but Andy, do you have any plans to enact these changes from the flat above number 10 anytime in the future?
Well, I am about to stand for a third time to be the mayor of Greater Manchester, and it is the best job I've had in my life. I have been Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, which was pretty good as well, I must say. But I've really kind of, finally, I think, I hope this doesn't sound too grand, I found my political voice a bit really in this job. The freedom of it has really suited me, and something after the Westminster years, it kind of reinvigorated me, really, and hence the book. We feel invigorated, don't we, about what we're doing and why we're doing it. I've never ruled out, though, one day maybe, you know, going back, and it would be to try and make happen some of the things we say in the book, because I don't think our ambitions for the north of England can be achieved only through what we're doing now in terms of leading our combined authorities. We're getting somewhere, but I do think that more substantial change to the way the country functions is needed as well. So I'm not going to rule it out. It's not happening anytime soon. And, you know, very much backing Keir and the party. We need a Labour government later this year, and, you know, we're very much focused on that.
Okay, so potentially head south in order to head north again, but not anytime soon.
Nice, I like it.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Andy, for joining us on the VAR FM.
Thanks, Craig.
Cheers, Craig.
Support independent journalism and set up a regular donation to Navara Media from just £1 a month. Head to navara.media/support or face the consequences.